All right, YouTube. We're also live on TikTok right now. How's everybody doing? And also, how are you doing, of course, out there on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you might be listening to the show? It's People Pleaser. It's Thursday, November 24th, in the evening. It's Thanksgiving. It's the day that we eat food and we try to avoid awkward conversations with our family. Some people in the comments already told me that they got into it with their family and that it was rough. I don't think I'm going to have that problem. My family dinner is going to be tomorrow. A lot of my family wasn't available to do it tonight, so we're doing it tomorrow. And I don't think I'm going to have that problem with my family. We don't all agree down the line on everything politically, but we also don't typically throw chairs and not speak to each other for a year after the meal because we get so content. Like, we're capable of like having a disagreement, but staying mostly cordial about it, I think. But I hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving. I hope you ate some good food. You know, like, obviously the Thanksgiving story is fucked, and obviously we should do a better job of teaching kids about what actually happened when the pilgrims came and just like committed genocide. That's what we should be telling kids instead of like, they all really liked each other. The buckle hat people and the feather band people all came together, and the feather band people said, here's how to make corn, and the buckle hat people said, oh, thanks, feather band people. We're never going to not be friends after this. And then all the buckle hat people were the worst people ever for several generations, continuing to today. Like, I don't think people realize that the genocide of the indigenous population of this country is ongoing, that like it's still happening, that we are like still continuously committing injustices to this community and like breaking treaties constantly and like infringing on their ground and on their territory and like, and dehumanizing them and leaving them out of our narrative and teaching their history incorrectly and our history incorrectly. This isn't an episode about Thanksgiving. I wanted to acknowledge that up front, that obviously the Thanksgiving story is stupid, but I do like the way that me and my family and my friends celebrate Thanksgiving, which is just, it's an excuse for us to get together, eat food with each other, and tell each other how much we love each other. And I'll take any opportunity I can find to do that. I really will. I'll take any opportunity to do that. So I like getting together with my family, eating food. I'm grateful for all of you. I'm grateful for the Blanket Fort Nation out there listening to this podcast every week. I'm in my parents' basement right now. I don't have my regular microphone. I got my travel mic. So we're going to have travel mic sound, and we're not going to have Blanket Fort recording studio sound. We're going to have bedroom in my parents' basement sound. Hopefully it sounds okay. But I am grateful for all of you and for your presence. I'm grateful for the people who are commenting on my videos and sharing my videos with people. Just the people who like consume my content and who have consumed my content over the last 3 years and who have helped me build these channels up, and you know, I'm thankful to you. Patreon patrons, I'm so grateful for you and your support. How about that? Patreon.com/AustinArcher if you don't know. I'm so grateful. You know what I'm not grateful for? The TikTok algorithm. Just continuously frustrated and not grateful for it. I'm sitting here right now on TikTok live, okay? And I have 33 people watching my stream. Now, it is Thanksgiving, but when we started the stream, there were 250 people. And I will just say, I bet you money, if I went on my For You page right now, I could just scroll for a while and find a page that has like 15,000 followers, and they would have like 800 people at their live stream. And TikTok never, ever, ever shows people that I'm live, ever. I have 1.2 million followers on that platform, and anytime I do a live stream, mostly because they don't like people to know that my podcast exists, and they don't, and a lot of other times that I do live streams, I sing, and TikTok doesn't like people to know that I'm a musician as well and that I sing. So we've got 40 people here now. So I'm not grateful for that. I am grateful for the TikTok platform for helping me have this job, I guess. I should be more grateful, okay? I'm grateful. I'm grateful for all of you. I'm grateful for the people who are here, for the 42 or 43 people who are here in the stream. I'm grateful for you. Thank you for being here. Let's get into the show. And for the people who are over on YouTube too, grateful for you as well, of course. Grateful for all of you. Thank you. Thank you genuinely from the bottom of my heart for being a part of this weird job that I have. For help, for you are the reason why I have the job. You allow me to have it. So really, truly, deeply, thank you. Let's get into the show. There have been several mass shootings in America in the last week, because that's how America's. That's just what America does, is mass shootings and not teaching their history correct. Those are just things that America excels at, is terrible things like that. And one of the most high-profile ones that I've definitely been talking a lot about on my channel, and that has been circulating in the media, is the shooting at Club Q in Colorado Springs. I've talked about this several times on my channel so far, and a lot on Twitter and on my different channels, that it is my feeling that it is not a hot take or a controversial take to say that talking heads and politicians on the right have blood on their hands anytime an act like this happens. It's like the shooting that happened at the grocery store in Buffalo, where the shooter had a manifesto talking about white replacement theory and all of this stuff, and Tucker Carlson is on his show preaching white replacement theory. Like, these people have blood on their hands. And every single time, I talked about this on my channel, there's a pattern. They do this stuff. They put this hateful rhetoric out into the ether. They, the people who are never actually going to pick up a gun themselves, you know, Ben Shapiro's never actually going to go out and pick up a gun. Steven Crowder's never actually going to go out and enact his beliefs in violence. Matt Walsh is never going to do that. Tucker Carlson's never going to do that. But they know that the people who listen to them are the kind, at least some of them, are the kind of people who will be inspired to act out violently by their words. They see it. They've seen it happen time and time again. So they do this stuff. They say this stuff. They heavily insinuate, and not even just insinuate, they just accuse queer people of being groomers and pedophiles, people who are coming for your kids, people who you need to get them before they get you. And then somebody goes and does it, and they go, and we go, see, that's why we told you not to say that, because it's dangerous. And they go, how dare you try to blame this on us? I can't believe you would, at a time like this, how dare you try to politicize this or blame us? That's the water we're swimming in right now, and it's very frustrating. And they all were really, really quick to go on the defensive online and say, this is not our fault, which I've also talked about this on my platforms, that, like, that's not a great sign. If you're rushing to the internet to tell everyone, this isn't my fault, I didn't do this, you just look super duper guilty, is all. Because I didn't rush to the internet to make sure everyone knows that nothing I said is the reason why Club Q happened. Because my audience, and even the people who aren't in my audience, even the conservatives who hate me, know that I didn't cause that, know that I didn't say anything to cause that. But all these people who are aware, they are, it shows, they tell on themselves when they do this. They're telling on themselves. It shows that on some level, they are aware that they are at least a little bit culpable when stuff like this happens. And they're so afraid of retribution or accountability that they rush to the internet to say, just in case anyone tries to blame me for this, it's not my fault. I just said stuff. I just shared opinions. I just said things. That's not the same as actually, I didn't go out and pull the trigger, okay? But it's like, yeah, but your rhetoric definitely fueled the gun being loaded and used, for sure. And the fact that you're here defending yourself so fervently really shows that on some level you understand that. Shows that on some level you get what you're doing. You understand that you are putting rhetoric out into the world and contributing to anti-LGBTQIA+ sentiment, contributing to a culture and a society that already historically has been terrible to this community. And you are contributing to the furthering of that marginalization, the furthering of that dehumanization, the furthering of that othering of those people. You know that you're contributing to that. So when mass violence is perpetrated on these people, you feel instinctively the need to make sure that you're covering your own ass, and that you're vehemently saying, I denounce violence like this. I think it's an evil act that happened. It's despicable. And I also think that anyone who tries to blame me for it is as bad as the shooter, if not worse. And your protestations really belie a guilty conscience. Or maybe not a guilty conscience, but just like unawareness that you may have had something to do with it. So in that vein, and here's the thing is, like, several people did this. Ben Shapiro did it. Tim Pool did it. Like, they literally said, not my fault. I didn't do this. How dare you suggest that I could have been responsible for this? And then they immediately went right back to saying, I mean, hey, but what do you expect when people are being groomers and pedophiles? Like, someone's going to do something about it. They immediately went right back to spewing the rhetoric. Like, they didn't wait at all. And in that same vein, almost like a day after the shooting happened, Herschel Walker came out with a new campaign ad. And it's him and Riley Gaines, who is a swimmer from the University of Kentucky, who is in this ad with him. And Riley is just so devastated and butthurt and heartbroken that she, in her own words, was forced to compete against a man in a swimming competition. She says, I practiced my whole life to be a swimmer, and then I was forced to compete against a man. So first of all, she wasn't forced. It's a voluntary swimming competition, non-mandatory. Don't know if you know that, Riley, but you don't actually have to participate in the competition if trans women make you feel icky. You don't actually have to do it. But Riley feels really wronged. And I want to talk about this. I want to talk about this specifically because I think when I say what I said at the beginning of the episode, like how this anti-trans, anti-gay, anti-queer rhetoric harms these communities, I think in the abstract, you all can see that. I think my audience in the abstract can see how that's true and goes like, yeah, absolutely. But I know way too many people, and I know that there are probably people in my audience, probably people who listen to this podcast. I know way too many people who think of themselves as being advocates and allies for the queer community, but who draw the line or have a hard time knowing where to stand when it comes to trans people in sports. Specifically, and let's just be realistic about it, trans women in sports. Not a lot of people actually care about trans men competing in sports, and we will get into why that is moving forward. But this is a thing where a lot of people who are advocates are still like, look, hey, I'll call you whatever pronouns you want to call. I will want to be called. I will be very careful not to misgender you. I will respect you. But, oh man, I just don't know what to do about trans people competing in sports. That's a tough one. That's complicated. I just, I don't know. And that's why I want to address this one too. I want to make sure that it's clear that you understand that the rhetoric that is out in the public discourse right now, demonizing trans people in sports, is just as harmful as any of the other anti-trans and anti-gay rhetoric, that it's the same thing. And I'm going to break it down now. And I can feel you. I can feel whoever you are out there, your butthole puckering up and tightening up, I can feel you getting defensive, like, no. I know I'm being reasonable about this because let's just be real. There are differences that we have to acknowledge. There are just real things at play here that we have to acknowledge. So I want to start here by saying that this is sort of what JJ and I were talking about on the podcast last week. If you haven't listened to that episode, it's fantastic. JJ absolutely crushed it, my guest last week. We talked about Kanye, but we really talked about like white supremacy infiltrating the black community and like the interplay between, you know, black people and Jewish people and these intersections of marginalization and all that stuff. But we talked a lot about how right-wing and centrist thinkers and even left-wing moderate thinkers tend to base a lot of their opinions on surface-level observations that seem intuitively correct without any further investigation. But when you investigate those surface-level observations and get curious about them and start asking why, using a Socratic method of saying, but why is that, and getting deeper and deeper, you see that it's not really the way that it appears. It's sort of like a person looking at an election map, and like, let's say Nevada, for instance. They look at the election map of Nevada and they see that it's mostly red and only has a few blue dots. And intuitively, on the surface, their surface level observation that feels intuitively correct is, that looks like a red state to me. That looks like that state should go for the Republicans. And if you don't do any other investigation, if that's all you do is just look at that surface level observation, you'd go, yeah, I mean, look at it. Look at it. Let's just be real. Are you looking at the same photo that I'm looking at? But if you get curious about it and go, okay, how many people live, and it's not hard, you just, how many people live in all of these red areas that are painted red versus how many people live in those blue dots, the answer becomes clear pretty quickly. Why it appears one way, but actually is another way. And that's sort of the same thing that's going on, I feel, with people's feelings around trans people in sports. And this is it's a good topic to talk about because this is somewhere where far-right, openly vitriolic transphobes and left-wing liberal advocates for trans people kind of meet. And they're kind of like, yeah, we sort of see eye to eye on this, that maybe it's not fair for specifically trans women to participate in women's sports. And on the surface level observation that's being made that feels intuitively correct is there's something inherently unfair taking place. And we all just have to acknowledge that. And you can just feel it in your guts that, like, someone who is born anatomically male will have certain physical advantages over someone who is born anatomically female. And that's, I don't know how we get around that and how that's fair to women who were born anatomically female who trained their whole lives to succeed in the sport and now have to compete against someone who just has at a base level, at a scientific, biological level, certain advantages that they don't possess that just doesn't feel fair. So the surface level intuitive observation is it's not fair. So let's start there, okay? That's the first thing, is it's unfair. I actually want to go back here really quick. We're going to get into why it's unfair. I just want to go back to Riley Gaines. Riley Gaines, who, this is the thing that set this all off. I just want to be really clear about who Riley Gaines is and what Riley Gaines' situation was. So Riley Gaines competed in a swimming competition, a voluntary swimming competition, not forced to compete in this swimming competition, voluntary swimming competition against several women, one of whom was a trans woman named Leah Thomas. Riley Gaines placed fifth in that race. So Riley Gaines is going around right now doing a media tour, doing commercials with Herschel Walker, going on Tucker Carlson's show, talking to anyone who will listen on the right and talking about how unfair her circumstances were, that it was unfair that she was, quote, forced to swim against, in her words, a man. So first of all, she lost the race. She came in fifth. So even if Leah Thomas hadn't been there, she would have come in fourth, meaning she still would not have taken the podium. So I'm not really sure what Riley Gaines's gripe is in this particular instance, because the women who took second and third shook Leah Thomas's hand and were good sports about it. It's almost like Riley Gaines has other motives, and she does, as evidenced by the fact that she refuses to call Leah Thomas a woman, calls her a man everywhere she goes. She went on Tucker Carlson's show and basically just said, I was so uncomfortable having to use the same changing room as a man. It's bad enough having to compete against a man. Now they're making me use the same locker room as a man. So Riley Gaines is just like one of those right-wing, open, loud, and proud transphobes. Like, she just doesn't like trans people. Trans people make her uncomfortable. So, like, right off the bat, it's sort of like, let's take Riley Gaines's like cries of foul play with the tiniest grain of salt, because she just is a bigot who doesn't like trans people and refuses to acknowledge Leah Thomas's identity as being valid. And also, like, Riley Gaines's whole thing is like, it's not fair that I trained my whole life and then I had to compete against Leah Thomas. And it's like, hey girl, you weren't close. You didn't compete against the three women who came above you, the three women who were born anatomically female, who placed above you, who weren't Leah Thomas. So, like, shut up. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you would not have been on the podium if Leah Thomas hadn't been there. Okay, so let's just get that out of the way, that, like, Riley Gaines is a transphobe who lost the race, okay? But let's go into this whole thing of, it's just unfair. It's not fair. It's not fair for someone who trains their whole life to have to compete against someone who has certain physical advantages over them that they just simply cannot possess. Okay. Again, this is a surface-level observation that feels intuitively true until you just get the slightest bit curious about it. Because ask yourself, Does that make sense to you? Is that how sports work? Is that the way that sports are designed? Is that people are not supposed to be made to compete against other people who have physical advantages over them? Just ask yourself that question. Does that ring true to you? Take trans people out of the equation. Is that how sports work? Is that how sports are designed to work? Is you're not supposed to have to compete against someone who has physical advantages over you? I grew up in an era, I'm a huge NBA fan. I grew up in an era where Muggsy Bogues was playing in the NBA against Shaquille O'Neal in his prime. Do you want to know what the physical stats of those two players are? Muggsy Bogues is a man who played in the NBA at 5'3" and 137 pounds. Shaquille O'Neal was playing in the NBA at his prime at 7'2", 325 pounds. By the way, the NBA's average height is like 6'5". So Muggsy Bogues is playing just like 2 heads shorter than every other person in the league and like at least 100 pounds lighter than every other person in the league. Shaquille O'Neal was like 3 of Muggsy Bogues, height-wise and weight-wise, and they were in the same league together. So, few things about that. Like, first of all, is it unfair to be over 7 feet and play in the NBA where the hoop is 10 feet tall and other players are 4 feet shorter than the hoop, but you have to just lift your hand up to put the ball in? Is that unfair? Does that make the sport unfair? I mean, we got guys who had trained their entire lives. They've worked their entire lives to be in the NBA, and they got to play against Shaquille O'Neal, who just bumps them into the paint and tosses them around like a rag doll. Is that fair? I don't know, but it goes to the question of, is it supposed to be fair? Are athletes owed a certain level of fairness? And if so, what is that level? What is the cutoff? When do you say this is too unfair? Because wouldn't it just seem intuitively at a glance that 7'2", 325 pounds is just too much of a physical advantage over 5'3", 137 pounds? It would just seem that way, right? But here's the thing. Muggsy Bogues was a competitor in the NBA. And Shaquille O'Neal, as dominant as he could be at times, lost games and sucked at shooting free throws. Like, that's the other thing about physical advantages, is that that's not all there is to sports. So let's go to swimming. So the sport that Leah Thomas won her event in. Michael Phelps dominated the sport of men's swimming for like 3 generations of Olympians. Again, you have men training around the world to be one of like the 20 best people in the world at this thing, working their entire lives, and nobody can beat Michael Phelps. At a certain level, and scientists would like studied Michael Phelps's body, and they were like, oh, it's because he has an abnormally long wingspan and shorter legs. His body is designed to be good at swimming. So again, I ask you, is that fair? Is that fair that people who trained their entire lives had to compete against Michael Phelps? And also I ask you, is it supposed to be fair? Are those swimmers owed some level of fairness? Like, should Michael Phelps have to wait 3 seconds for all of them to get a head start so that we're leveling the playing field? And again, I will also say that physical advantages are not all there is in sports. How many times do you see a player who has all the natural physical gifts but is missing what some people in sports call the X factor? A lot of people call it intangibles. Because you can have every physical gift and physical advantage there is in the world, and if you don't have like a certain work ethic or a certain like confidence or a certain je ne sais quoi, a certain just like ability to turn it on, a competitiveness, that X factor, you might be worse than someone with the X factor. Like, how did Muggsy Bogues compete in the NBA? Tom Brady, objectively, so many people have no problem accepting that Tom Brady is probably the best person to ever play the game of football, the game of American football. Look at Tom Brady and tell me that he is physically engineered to be the best football player to ever live. He's just not. You look at the guy and it's like, that's not how I would draw it up. Those aren't the specs that I would draw up in the lab if I was engineering. If I was biologically engineering the perfect football player, I wouldn't make him look like Tom Brady. I'd probably give him stats more like a Michael Vick or a, you know, like a Deion Sanders. Like, that's probably who I would draw up as, like, the ideal football physique. But you've got this, like, kind of, like, mid-looking, fine, like, he's not totally cut. He's just got, like, a fine physique white guy, kind of a dorky white guy. And he's just, for whatever reason, intangibles, X factor, he's just one of the best, if not the best, to ever do it. So again, it's like, the questions are, is it supposed to be fair? Are you owed a certain level of fairness? Is there any sport where people are not made to compete against other people who have more physical advantages over them? And also, is physical advantages all there is to being competitive in sports? And I think the answer to, like, all those things is no. Like, that's not all there is to being competitive in sports. Peyton Manning's another great example. Like, why was Peyton Manning so good at football? Who knows? Who knows? Maybe it's just in his genes, but he doesn't look like he should be good at any sports. The guy looks like he's had back problems since he was 20. Like, he looked like he was 50 when he was 20, 25, and for some reason he just kept winning football games. Okay. So that's the first thing. That's the first thing. That's that first surface level observation is, it's just not fair. There are just certain physical advantages that will be there that you can't get over. So I think we thoroughly unpacked that. The next thing that people will go to is they'll just go, look, there is just a scientific reality here at play. There are two different anatomies at play, and we can make trans people feel welcome by using their proper pronouns and by you know, calling them by whatever name they want to be called and by accepting them in most spaces in society as the gender that they feel most comfortable as. But when it comes to sporting, we just have to be real about the fact that an athlete who is born anatomically male will always have an advantage over an athlete who is born anatomically female. That's just how it's going to be, and there's just a scientific reality at place there. I mean, Leah Thomas, for example. Leah Thomas, the one that Riley Gaines, the transphobe, was freaking out about. Riley Gaines may not have placed in that race, but Leah Thomas did set records. And this is the thing, is people are really upset that Leah Thomas is dominating in women's swimming right now. That's what they're upset about, is that she's dominating, that she's setting records. And that's true. In that event that Riley Gaines is talking about, Leah Thomas set the pool record and an Ivy League record for the women's 500 meter freestyle. Okay, so, like, good on Leah Thomas. She swam the 500 meter freestyle in a very impressive 4 minutes and 37 seconds, which was 7 seconds faster than anyone else in the pool. So right now at this point, you're going, Austin, do you hear yourself? This is what we're talking about. She just naturally had the ability to do something that an athlete who was born anatomically female could not have done. That's why she set those records. Oh boy, you're so sure of yourself right now, aren't you? You feel so good about yourself. The only problem is, what Leah Thomas didn't do is she didn't set the world record in that event, or even the American record. Do you want to know who set the American record? Are you excited to find out? Because I'm so excited to tell you that it was 7 years ago, and it was Katie Ledecky who swam that exact same event in 4 minutes and 26 seconds, a whole 11 seconds faster than Leah Thomas. And get this, this is the part that's going to blow your brain right out your butt. Katie Ledecky was born anatomically female. How could that possibly be? How could that possibly be? How could a woman who was born anatomically female ever swim faster than a woman who was born anatomically male? I mean, let's get real. I was born anatomically male, and if I swam in that race, I would have taken dead last. Everyone would have been home having dinner with their families, and I still would have been in the pool being like, you guys, we have to call it. Like, I have I need to go to the hospital. And they'd be like, you have to finish the race. We can't close the gym until you finish the race. And I'd be like, it's either we call it or I drown. And then I just, like, finish the race at, like, I don't know, 3 hours or something like that. You know, that's the funny thing, is, like, you go to this place of, like, obviously, a woman who was born anatomically male is just going to be able to do things that no woman who was born anatomically female would be able to do. That's just obvious. But it's just not true. It's just not true. There are probably thousands, millions of women in the world who could kick my ass. And you go, well, Austin, you're not a professional athlete, so we're not really talking about the same thing. But, like, aren't we? Aren't we? Because it goes back to the thing of, like, X factor, intangibles, like, competitiveness. Like, are you naturally athletically gifted or not? I am not. So it wouldn't matter who I'm competing against, and a man born anatomically male, a trans man born anatomically female, or a woman born anatomically female, or a trans woman born anatomically male. It wouldn't matter who I was competing against. I'm going to lose to, like, most people. I'm pretty decent at bowling. So if you're not a professional bowler, I might have, like, a decent shot at, like, competing against you there. But, like, yeah, the whole Katie Ledecky thing I love, because it just blows that whole theory up that, like, a woman who was born anatomically male would just be able to do things that a woman who was born anatomically female wouldn't be able to do. Okay, then why is Katie Ledecky 11 seconds faster than Leah Thomas? Answer that question. Why? And here's the other part of that argument that really starts falling apart. Again, Socratic method, just keep digging, keep digging, keep staying curious, is why does no one care about trans men who beat cisgender men in sports? Why does no one care about that? That does happen. That's a thing that happens. Now, it's a little bit harder to go out and find examples of trans male athletes who are dominating and who are constantly winning, or like who are the best in their field. But that doesn't mean that you can't find examples of trans men athletes who are going up against cisgender male athletes and beating them, going up head to head. So let's say it's a team sport. Let's say like it's rugby or something like that. Like, there are still going to be instances where a trans man on that team could be stronger or faster or just like outplay a man who was born anatomically male on the other team. But that player doesn't have to be like the best player on that team. So it's interesting that we don't care about that. And I also think that this brings up another really, really solid point, which is one of the big reasons why I don't think we care as much about trans men competing in men's sports is we sort of prefer it if they're a little bit quieter. We're sort of like, yeah, it's fine as long as you're not making too much noise. It's fine as long as you're not like being too showy about it, and we don't have to like deal with you making a gold medal on the podium. Do you see just inherently the problem with that? That like everyone would be fine with Leah Thomas competing in swimming if she didn't win? That we would be totally fine with Leah Thomas competing if she lost? And we probably don't want her to podium at all. Like, we don't want her to get silver. We don't want her to get bronze. We want her to kind of be like a Riley Gaines type, you know, like a fifth or sixth place type. That's what we would feel more comfortable with. But it only becomes a problem when she wins. So like, that's really interesting. That's sort of, if you investigate and if you're honest, it's like, why is that? What is that about? Why are we only concerned about this if she's winning? Why is it only a problem if they're winning? And again, you could go back to like, because that means that it's not fair. And again, we go back into the circle of like, is it supposed to be fair? Are people owed fairness? Are they like that whole thing? But the fact that you only care about it if they win really shows something there about like not wanting these people to succeed subconsciously. I think in this issue, a thing that a lot of people don't realize is there is like so much unconscious bias at play here. There is so much stuff happening, so much unexamined internalized transphobia that is not being examined by people who have a problem with trans athletes. And it, like, these are the things that you have to get curious about. It's like, why do I only care if they win? Why do I only have a problem if they win? Which brings up another question. So I already asked the question, are sports supposed to be inherently fair? And I think that you can make a really, really, really solid argument that no, they are not supposed to be inherently fair. The other question that I would ask is the purpose of competing in sports and learning a sport and participating in sports, is the purpose of doing that solely to win? Is that the purpose? And again, on the surface, you might go, yeah, of course. Of course. But if that's true, that means that the vast majority of people who ever played sports, because most people who compete in a sport don't go professional. Most people who learn a sport and compete in a sport don't ever even wind up playing that sport at the collegiate level. But if they do, most of those people don't wind up going professional. And if they do wind up going professional, most of those people don't wind up dominating in their field and being one of the best to ever do it. The amount of people that actually achieve the level of like greatness and being one of the best to ever do it is very, 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 very small. So if we're boiling down the entire cultural practice of participating in team sports and sports in general, participating in competitive sports and competitive athletics, if we're boiling all of that down to it's only worthwhile if you're winning, we're being really, really reductive about what sports is or what sports are and like how they function in our society. And I don't think that we actually typically boil sports down to being worthwhile based on whether or not you're winning. I don't think we typically do that. I think we only do it when trans people are involved, specifically, again, trans women. Like, it only becomes a problem when we see a trans woman winning in a sport that aligns with her gender. And I think that's a really, really interesting observation that belies some of that internalized transphobia, some of that internalized bias, that internalized prejudice. And people always, when I say this stuff too, I know this is another one of those things that makes people tighten up and get defensive because they're like, no, I don't have internalized transphobia. I don't have internalized bias. I don't have internalized prejudice. Well, here's the fun thing about internalized prejudice and internalized bias and internalized transphobia. You wouldn't know it if you had it. It wouldn't be internalized if you had it. You would be aware of it and you would be working on it. Internalized means that it's, maybe I can use the term unconscious because that they're sort of synonyms. Unconscious bias, unconscious transphobia. These are things that like you are not conscious of. You're not aware of them. They are things that were baked into you by society, by culture, by just like so many things the way you were raised, by religion, by politics, by just everything that you saw in the world growing up around you. It baked in these unconscious internalized biases. And that's why I'm like, I'm digging at this thing going, so your problem is when trans people win, is the whole point of sports to win. And this also goes to trans men competing in sports. So like you're fine with it because they're not winning and they're just kind of keeping quiet. But trans men really shine a light on like why it's important for trans people to be able to compete in the sport that aligns with their gender. Because for a lot of trans men who aren't maybe dominating in their field, but are playing competitively in their field, who are respected by their peers, who are respected by their fellow athletes, it's not about being the best the world has ever seen. It's simply about being recognized as a man, being recognized as a person who plays men's sports because you are a man. It is about identity. It is about society and culture saying you are not a woman, you are a man, therefore you play men's sports. So it's about more than winning and losing. It's about more than who has the competitive edge or who has what physical advantage over who. Because again, that's such a small portion of what makes sports the societal institution that they are. And we've already established why that is. But like, it goes deeper. It's not just about, are you winning? Are you losing? Who's dominating? It's about, are you being recognized by society and by culture as what you are? And so that brings us to our next problem, which is when we get really deep about this thing, we get past the surface level observation of, oh, well, it's not fair. Or we get past the surface level observation of, there are just two anatomies at play here that don't coincide with each other. And we just have to be realistic about that. We get past that. And what it really comes down to, the real question you need to ask yourself, if you don't know where you sit on this issue is, do you actually accept trans identities as being valid? Do you actually accept trans men as being men and trans women as being women? And so a lot of people will say, hey, look, again. And if they're being honest with themselves, they'll go, I am totally fine with calling someone a woman if that's what they want to be called. But I got to get real about the fact that there are XX chromosomes and there are XY chromosomes. And people will literally be like, this is where I think the left is going too far. People who align socially liberal and left on so many things will be like, we're going too far when we try to insinuate that a person who was born anatomically male actually has XX chromosomes. They just don't. There are just two different things here. So in your mind, you are still compartmentalizing and setting aside trans women and trans men as this other thing where you're like, I'll call them whatever they want to be called. But I'm sorry, just scientifically, there is a binary here that we have to acknowledge. So a few things about the XXXY thing. This is an argument I hear all the time. People bring it up all the time, that this is just a hard binary here that we have to respect. Few things about this. First of all, this is a straw man argument. No one who is advocating for the validity of trans identities has ever said that trans men actually have XY chromosomes and that trans women, and I should say trans men in general and trans women in general, actually have XX chromosomes. That is not an argument that anyone is making. No one has ever said, no, you have, if you say that a trans woman has XY chromosomes, you're a bigot. No one has ever said that. So when your counter argument is, hey, we just got to be real here. We just got to be real here about the fact that XX chromosomes exist and XY chromosomes exist. And we got to get down to the nitty gritty, down to the nuts and bolts of it and be real. You're contending with an argument that no one's making, which is the definition of a straw man. You're contending with an argument that no one has ever said that people don't have their different chromosomal makeups. That's the first mistake you're making. The second mistake that you're making is thinking that XX and XY are a fixed binary. They just aren't. And you can just go and do your own research on this. You can go and just type in, are there only two chromosomal orientations for human beings to have? Just go and type it in right now. You can pause the podcast and go onto Google and type in, are there only two chromosomal orientations for human beings to have? Any biologist worth their salt will tell you, or any reputable scientific journal that studies biology and sexuality and sexual identification and gender identification will tell you that no, XX and XY are the orientations in the majority of cases. So most of the time, people who are born anatomically female have an orientation of XX, and people who are born anatomically male have an orientation of XY. But that's just most the time, which means that some of the time, no, weirdly enough. Some of the time, people who are born with female anatomy are born with XY chromosomes. There are even different arrangements. There's XYX or XYY or XXY. Sometimes people's chromosomal makeup changes as their life goes on. This happens. So like this fixed binary that you're basing your definition of what is a man and what is a woman off of is fake. It's not real. And you can say, yeah, but most the time. Okay, but most the time means not all the time. Literally, I mean, like Ben Shapiro will say this. Steve Crowder will say this. Matt Walsh will say this. They'll go like, look, the fact of the matter is like most the time women are born with XX chromosomes. And it's like, Even they, these like vitriolic transphobes on the right will acknowledge that it is not a fixed binary. And that's just something where like you cannot say the world is round or spherical most the time, but sometimes it's flat. You can't say that. It's not there are things that are fixed. So people want to say, look, we got to get real about the fact that a woman is a woman and a man is a man, and that these chromosomal makeups are the things that we cannot ignore. First of all, no one is ignoring them. No one's pretending like they don't exist. But they're not actually the fixed binary that you think they are. And if something is only the way that it is most of the time, that means that there are times that it is not that thing, which means that you have to start seeing that thing as spectral and not a binary, not either or, but a spectrum. The fact that people can have an anatomical orientation that does not match their chromosomal orientation tells you everything that you need to know. And then we get into questions of like, what is sex versus what is gender? So sex is usually what you are assigned at birth based on your anatomical makeup. That's PPs and VVs, okay? That's what they see between your legs. They say they assign you a sexual... That's what they assign you in the hospital based on your anatomical makeup. That does not necessarily pertain to your chromosomal makeup, as we just discussed, but that's what sex is. Gender is a whole other thing. Gender is this social construct that is typically assigned to people who fit most of the criteria of one or the other of these things that are like a loose binary, but we have just discussed are actually scientifically spectral. But typically gender is a matter of performing a certain role in society. How do you present in society? And how do you identify internally? What feels more true to you? And that there has to be room for that in a world where we can acknowledge that scientifically we cannot lock down the binary. So I'm talking about all of this because if after getting through, well, it's not fair, or if after getting through, well, there are certain physical advantages, or if after getting through, okay, I guess maybe the point of sports isn't to be fair or isn't to always win, and you just get down to, we just have to have men be men and women be women, then we get into the question, okay, do you find trans identities to be valid? And if you're still saying, okay, I don't actually, and I do think there is a difference, you're basing that on bad science. It's something that intuitively seems right on the surface, because you're going, in my life, I know when I'm looking at a woman and I know when I'm looking at a man. That's the way I was raised, is with this thing that appears to be a fixed binary. But again, get more curious, ask more questions, it gets more complicated. And once you can accept that and see that, and it becomes easier to start saying, I guess I can just say a trans woman is a woman, and trans is a descriptor in front of that woman. That descriptor means that that woman most likely was born anatomically male. That's all that means, but she's still a woman. And a cisgender woman is a woman who was born anatomically female, but she's still a woman. And you can get, that becomes an easier thing to do. And once you can do that and get to a place where you can accept in your brain that trans women are women and that trans men are men, you can start to see why it actually makes no sense to want to force trans men and trans women to play sports in the wrong gender orientation. So, okay. That's a lot of things. All of this now, okay? All right? You're with me. I gotta tell people on the podcast right now, we're up to 130 people on the live stream, so we're doing well. We went from 30 to 130. People are here. People are talking in the comments. People are responding. People are dropping hearts. People are getting into it in the comments. We've gotten through all that stuff, okay? We've broken all of that down. Now comes the big question of, why is this a talking point at all? Why are we having this discussion? Why are we in society, and most of us being cisgender people, why are we wringing our hands and having this conversation over whether or not it's appropriate for trans women to play women's sports or trans men to play men's sports? And that's really the big question, is where does this talking point come from? Why is it something that we're all talking about? Well, it comes from the same place that critical race theory comes from. How were we all of a sudden talking about critical race theory? Well, it came from people who did not want schools teaching history accurately, coming up with a talking point that could rope in gullible people who are not going to dig and investigate and ask questions. So what they sold these people on is that schools are teaching your kids and indoctrinating your kids from kindergarten up with a Marxist ideology that teaches them that white people are inherently bad and black people are inherently good and victims, and that you can't get out of that. None of that is what critical race theory is. None of that. It's not even close. And I've done an episode on this podcast about critical race theory. We're not talking about critical race theory today, but I'm talking about this concept of selling this lie to people, saying, do you want your kids being indoctrinated with a narrative that tells them that they are inherently bad because of the color of their skin? Again, a thing that on the surface, unexamined, seems intuitively like, yeah, no, I don't want my kid to be taught that. But get a little bit curious. Okay, let me find out if A, schools are actually teaching that to my kid. They aren't. And B, what actually is critical race theory? Because it's none of the things that they're telling me that it is, if I actually get curious about it. That's the exact same place that this talking point comes from, okay? That's why I say that this talking point is just as dangerous and harmful to the trans community as any of the other talking points about trans people being groomers or pedophiles, or gay people being groomers or pedophiles, drag queens being dangerous for kids. It is just as harmful, the rhetoric around trans people in sports. The idea behind it was invented. This talking point was created by open transphobic people to ensnare reasonable people, unsuspecting reasonable people who are supportive of trans people in other cases, to go, hey, look, what about this, though? What about this? Isn't it unfair that this girl, Riley Gaines, had to compete against Leah Thomas? Who had, like, that's not fair, right? And unexamined, they're tapping into your unconscious bias, they're tapping into your unconscious transphobia, and they're getting you to go, you know what? Yeah, that's a good point. Man, that's a tough topic. But the point of them selling you on this talking point is to perpetuate the idea that trans identities are not valid, that just like Riley Gaines said, that Leah Thomas is a man, not a woman, that trans identities are not valid, that trans men are not men, and that trans women are not women. So to invalidate and delegitimize the lived experience and the identity of trans people, that's the first big thing. And the second big thing, the thing that makes it really dangerous for trans people, is once you've dehumanized them, taken away the legitimacy of their identity, you perpetuate the narrative that trans people are predatory. So the narrative that Leah Thomas is coming in and stealing trophies from all of these anatomical women who worked their entire lives to be competitive in swimming, only to have it stolen from them, ripped away by this predatory man who's dressing up as a woman to gain access into female-only spaces and steal things from them and prey on them, just like the narrative about trans people in their proper bathrooms. It's not about being seen as the gender that you are and being accepted by society, it's about them being predatory, being predators. And as we know, that's very, very dangerous rhetoric, because if you're telling people that these people aren't, they don't want to compete in the sport that aligns with their gender identity simply because that's the gender that they are and that makes more sense for them, the reason they want to do it is because they're predatory, because they're looking to, which is, again, get curious. Just ask yourself if a person would actually go through the process of medically transitioning just so that they could win a trophy. If a person would actually take on the burden of living as in an identity that has been historically marginalized, and an identity that is attacked and violently brutalized regularly, so that they can maybe have a chance of being more competitive in their sports. Like, it's such a clearly dehumanizing narrative. It's a narrative that is so clearly designed to get you upset at trans people, or at least at Leah Thomas. If we can start with Leah Thomas, if you can go, hey, look, I usually don't have a problem with trans people, but I don't like what Leah Thomas is doing. That's the goal. That's the goal, is to continue the process of you othering trans people, to continue the process of you thinking of trans people as not actually the gender that they are, and of you thinking of trans people as being secretly predatory, that the actual reason they want to transition has something to do with stealing something from these spaces that they wouldn't have access to if they didn't go through that transition. That's really kind of like my whole spiel. And I went a lot longer than I thought I was going to go, but I kind of like had a lot of heat to drop, and I think I kind of fucking nailed it. And I'm open to the comment sections now to see if anybody wants to challenge me on this and let me know where I might be wrong, or where I may have misspoken, or any of my points that I brought up that you want to contend with. Because I kind of think I just went point by point through anything that you might be stuck on and told you why you shouldn't be stuck on that. But let's hear it. Let's see. Is anybody out there? Fred Garvin says on YouTube, I'm a little hesitant to engage in this forum. I feel I've been marginalized. Fred, do you feel like you are in the minority here? So Fred says, trans people now have the media and corporate America in their corner. You guys are safer than you've ever been. Hey, Fred, little news for you. Just like a few days ago on Trans Day of Visibility, a gay club was attacked with a bunch of trans people in it, and several trans people were murdered because people still hate and want to cause harm to trans people. That, like, just happened, Fred. That's actually the entire reason why we're doing this episode. And also, like, a few more trans people being on TV shows and movies doesn't mean we've, like, arrived at the mountaintop of trans acceptance in the media and in corporate America. So, like, I know that you're seeing more trans people on TV and in movies than you're used to, but that doesn't mean that, like, trans identities have been fully normalized, as evidenced by you, Fred. By you, a person who still probably most likely does not accept trans people as being legitimate. And you probably have lots of friends who feel the same way as you do. And you probably actually have a pretty good amount of animosity toward this community. So, like, all you need to do to know that what you just said is total bullshit is just look inward and be, like, the slightest bit inquisitive to yourself. And see if, like, oh, well, the fact that I still hate trans people or have a big problem with trans people. Okay, so here's Fred saying, yes, that was horrible, the shooting. So you acknowledge that it happened, even after you just said that they've never been safer than they ever were. And you said, I wish all trans people and LGBTQ people the best of success in all their ventures. That's very nice, Fred. That's very, very nice of you to say. But do you understand how, like, you just said they've never been safer? And maybe you're right. You actually might have a point, Fred, that in history, this may be one of the safest times that trans people have ever had. But that's not saying much. I want you to understand that, like, just because this might be, I don't even know if it fully is. I mean, like, it probably actually isn't, because there are, in American history, let's say in American history, in modern American history, because we know that our indigenous population, the population that, hey, it's Thanksgiving, the population that we committed genocide against, they actually had two-spirit people, and they still do have two-spirit people, and they were always accepted and actually, like, revered in the community, and they were incredibly safe in that community. It was colonialism and the spread of Western Christianity that actually started to, like, really make life in modern Western society very unsafe for trans people. So maybe in the history of modern Western civilization, this is one of the safest periods to be a trans person. That does not mean that trans people are fully safe in society. There is still so much further to go. So if you're a person who's saying they've never had it better, why does everyone keep talking about this? What you should be saying is they've never had it better and there's so much further to go. It's crazy how much work still needs to be done. So, like, you're halfway there on what you're saying. Kim Griffith says, my friend was an elite swimmer. She has a bit of a different perspective, even while agreeing with you. What is her perspective? I would love to know, Kim. Hi from Mexico, says Carla over on YouTube. Hi from Mexico. I love your content and the way you explain these things. Hugs and kisses. Well, hugs and kisses back to you as well. Somebody says, Katie Miller, 625 on TikTok says, does Fred know that our founding fathers wore wigs, lifted shoes, and tights? Yeah, exactly. I also love that, like, gender norms. You can explore that whole history. All the people that are like, what happened to men? Men used to be like this, and now they're like this. And they'll, like, show a photo of, like, Harry Styles wearing a dress or something. And it's like, well, keep going back. Like, you're going back, like, 80 years and being like, men used to dress like this, now they dress like this. It's like, okay, go back 150 years, like, or even like 100 years. Little boys used to wear dresses when they were like toddlers, just like 100 years ago. So it's really funny how people, again, it's a surface level observation. Showing one photo, showing a photo of soldiers storming Normandy on D-Day, and juxtaposing it with a picture of Harry Styles, let alone the fact that, like, androgyny in rock and roll has kind of always existed. Like, it's sort of a staple of the genre for lead singers in pop music and rock and roll to, like, indulge in androgyny. And that's been a thing for, that's not a new thing. That's not like a Gen Z thing. That's not like a woke leftist thing. Like, you know, see David Bowie, see, like, any hair rock band from the 80s, did you see that Kim answered you? I did not. Let me see it. Let me see here. Oh, so Kim Griffith says, in terms of coaching, access to coaching, it's not a matter of being the best. Yeah, I mean, I think that coaching doesn't need to be gendered either. Like, I think that coaching, there are all kinds of people who make very successful coaches who maybe weren't the most competitive in their heyday when they were competing in the sport. Because a lot of coaches are former players. Not all of them. Like, I just got kicked off of live on TikTok. They suspended my live. Wow. Okay. Your live access was suspended for violating our hateful behavior policy. We don't allow content that, one, attacks, threatens, incites violence against, or dehumanizes an individual or group based on protected attributes. Wow, it's almost like I was doing the exact opposite of that. It's almost like I was doing the polar opposite of that for the last hour and 20 minutes. How weird. How weird that I got suspended for doing the polar opposite of what they're saying I was doing. But that's just TikTok. I said at the beginning of this episode that I am not grateful for TikTok, and I'm going to go ahead and double down on that. That, like, fuck TikTok big time. God, I hate those guys. But to the point about coaching, yeah, like, Rick Spoelstra, who's a coach for the Miami Heat, was never a player. But typically coaches tend to be former players. And it doesn't always coincide that, like, the best coaches were the best players. Like, Steve Kerr played on one of the best teams in the history of the NBA, but he wasn't necessarily, like, one of their best players. He was a good player, very good player, very competitive. But Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman were the best players on that team. And I do, I think that trans people in sports actually are a thing. It's a thing that needs to happen more so that we can start to see more and more that our gender binary, our perceived gender binary is and always has been spectral. And then maybe we can start having more involvement of, you know, women coaching men's sports and vice versa. There's already some trends that I'm liking seeing around professional men's sports, like female officials being on the court. I like seeing that, like women who are officiating and who are refereeing and stuff. And one that I really like in the NBA that's a new trend that I'm like, that's really cool, is always growing up, every team had dancers for their team. And it was this very, like, objectifying, misogynistic thing where these, like, skimpily dressed women would come out and dance during timeouts. And it was all based around this idea of, like, sports are for men, and men are here watching sports. So you're in the timeout, you're going to watch these skimpy, you know, like, these, like, women who are doing routines that look like they're dancing literally at a strip club, dancing in the timeouts. And now every single team's dance squad is co-ed, has men and women, is co-gender. And, like, I think that that's really cool. I think that's a really cool step in the right direction. And I think that the more sports does this, and the more that, like, men athletes support women athletes and vice versa, and the more that there's, like, I think it's going to be good for our society to see that, like, there's not just this clear division where just, like, men are just better at it, and in general, women are just worse at it. It's like, why could a woman not coach a men's basketball team at least as good as, like, Jim Boylan could? If you don't know who Jim Boylan is, he's just, like, this really bad coach who coached in the NBA for a while and was bad at it. Let's see here what they're saying on YouTube. We might need to wrap it up here because I got kicked off of TikTok and I got to plead my case. And, you know, Callie Herbert says, Austin, I know it sounds weird, but I think you sound digestible to people that are on the verge of acceptance of marginalized groups. I could show this to my uncle at Thanksgiving and they would think that I am less crazy than usual. That's the goal. Callie, that's absolutely the goal, is to, for anyone who's willing to spend an hour listening to me talk about this, that's the goal, is to just, like, point by point, take apart your defenses, take apart your arguments, and show you that, like, there's not much there. And all you're really left with, once you take all those things away, is, like, how do you feel? How do you feel about trans people? And getting real about that, getting real about getting honest and looking inward. And I'm saying the same thing to Fred here, who's like halfway there, who's close, who's like sort of getting it, but he's stopping short. And he's not realizing that, like, while he agrees with me, he's still kind of like keeping his feelings. Keeping it, and that's the thing that is left for Fred on his own and in his own time to examine is like, how do you feel about trans people and why do you feel that way? And Fred even said, look, Fred, I'm really proud of you. Fred said, Callie has a point, except some of your adversaries might be less on the verge of acceptance and more at pure acceptance. I mean, yes and no, like you're here, Fred, you know, and he says, I've actually become more conservative over the past couple of years. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have, like, conservatives have a very well-funded and effective media machine and social media machine. Look at my show. Like, my show is me in my parents' basement with, like, lights that I bought myself. My show's not the same show as Steven Crowder's show or Ben Shapiro's show. I don't get my own network that's funded by, you know, billionaires. People on the right will tell you, the talking heads on the right will tell you that the media or that the left wing owns the media and that we own all of the apparatuses that are disseminating the messages for society, while literally telling you that from, like, the number one news network in the country and from, like, the best funded YouTube show you've ever seen. And you'll watch that and not realize that they're telling you that we have all the money while they're sitting in an objectively more expensive space than we are. And in an objectively, like a production that has more money and more support behind it than we do. The other reason why their media apparatus is so effective on people like you is their talking points are easier to digest. Their talking points tend to be surface-level observations that intuitively feel right, and they just hammer those things home over and over and over for you. So that's what I was talking about in this whole episode is, like, a lot of what makes you feel intuitively like there's something wrong with trans people competing in sports is surface-level observations that intuitively feel correct without any further investigation. But if you actually investigate into it, it doesn't hold water. Fred just said, the media's shtick is decidedly left-wing, even though their corporate ethos is likely dominant. That's just not true. Again, the number one news network in the country is Fox News. So you just can't say that, Fred. Like, just objectively, you're incorrect. I know that you're told by these people over and over and over again that the media is owned and run by leftists. There actually aren't any well-funded leftist media outlets in the same way that there are well-funded far-right extremist media outlets like Fox News, like Breitbart, like The Daily Wire, like OAN. There are moderate left-leaning media outlets like MSNBC and CNN, but they are not far left. There aren't any well-funded far left media outlets. There is no media equivalent to Fox News when it comes to how extreme they lean on one side. So the media that you're consuming from people like Steven Crowder, Matt Walsh, Ben Shapiro, this is extremist rhetoric. This is far-right extremist rhetoric, and it is incredibly well-funded far-right extremist rhetoric. All far left extremist rhetoric, like, I'm pretty far left, but I don't go so far to the point where, like, I'm a full-blown anarchist who wants violent revolution. Like, I stop short at that, but, like, I'm pretty far left on everything when it comes to social issues. But, like, you won't see someone as far left as me with their own show on CNN or MSNBC. You just won't see it. You won't see someone as far left as me with their own show on any major network. You won't see someone as far left as me with major corporate backing, because anyone that's funding something that leans left still always wants to try to cheat towards center to try to get the biggest possible audience because they have a capitalistic bias. It's only the right-wing media mechanism that like is all in on the extremist takes. Yeah, so somebody said, Goaty Goat said, the far left isn't commercially lucrative. That's not necessarily true. It's just for whatever reason, like, we've never really been able to get traction. Like, I think that the far left could be just as commercially lucrative as the far right has become. There are more people on the left in America than there are on the right. Like, that's why the left tends to win popular votes every single time we have an election in this country. But, like, for whatever reason, I think it's this. It's this. It's that moneyed interests have capitalistic bias, and far left is anti-capitalist. It's that simple. So, like, that's the reason why. It's not that it's not commercial, it's not scalable, or you wouldn't be able to make money on it. It's not that people wouldn't watch it. People would watch it. People would consume it. It's just that the people who are funding the bigger platforms are people who have a vested interest in upholding capitalism. So. Well, how weird is that? How wild is that that I got banned off of TikTok? I'm really glad that Fred was here to give us a good example of, like, why we do conversations like this, why we have episodes of the podcast like this, and, like, why it's worthwhile. Because even if it's just Fred that maybe has heard some new ideas on this episode and gone, like, huh, that's an interesting thought that I hadn't considered before, I'll think about it further, that's worth it. But I'm also, like, willing to bet that there are people in my audience that listened to this episode that went, when you started out, I wasn't expecting to agree with you. And by the end, I'm hoping that maybe on a few things at least, you're at least considering a new idea. So that's all. That's all we have. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I'm going to go whine to TikTok and say, hey, come on, guys. Quit banning me for things that I didn't do. And they're not going to listen. And they're going to say, shut up. We don't care. And that's how that's going to go. Thanks for being here. Thank you for participating in the comments, in the chat. Thank you for everybody. Thank you, Fred. Thank you, Callie. Thank you, everybody. And to everyone on TikTok, I lost your names because it shut down. But I really, really appreciate you being here. Let me know out there in the ether if this episode got under your skin, if you feel like I'm wrong in any way. I want to hear from you because I know that this is sort of a divisive topic for people. So I want to hear from you, please. And thank you. That's it. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. You can find my music on Spotify, on Apple Music, Patreon.com/AustinArcher. Talked about them at the beginning of the episode, but let's talk about them again. You can support this show, this YouTube channel, my TikTok, my Instagram, everything that I do if you go over to Patreon.com/AustinArcher if you want to. If you've got that expendable income to, like, shoot me $4 or $5 a month, we'd love to have you over there. And I love all the people that are over there. Thank you so much. I'm thankful for all of you. I really am. Thank you for allowing me to continue doing this. We'll see you next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Love you so much. Bye-bye. Oh, my. Since I've been more, I know the less I know.